Welcome to the Best Interest Podcast, where we believe Benjamin Franklin's advice that an investment in knowledge pays the best interest, both in finances and in your life. Every episode teaches you personal finance and investing in simple terms. Now, here's your host, Jesse Kramer.
Hello, and welcome to episode 77 of the Best Interest Podcast. My name is Jesse Kramer. Later in today's episode, Peter Lazaroff is going to be joining us. Peter is the Chief Investment Officer at PlanCorp in St. Louis. PlanCorp is a multi-billion dollar wealth management firm serving clients across the country, very similar to my firm in that regard. So Peter and I kind of share that in common. Peter's star is rising. Peter is the Chief Investment Officer there, as I said. He also hosts the Long-Term Investor podcast, which I love the name, the Long-Term Investor. I love the content. I highly recommend it. Previous guests on Peter's podcast have included Morgan Housel, William Bernstein, Burton Mulkeel, Ben Carlson, and even somehow myself, Jesse Kramer, which is awesome. It's so much fun. And it's kind of like if Mount Rushmore had this fifth face, you know, hiding off somewhere in the woods to the side. I don't know exactly how I made that list, but I'm very thankful for Peter for having me on his podcast. And anyway, Peter's great. Our conversation today is fantastic. It's all about investing in the stock market at all-time highs, which ostensibly we are at right now. Peter and I spoke last week. I think it was the first week of March when we spoke. I'm recording this right now on March 16th. I know this episode might not come out until a little bit towards the end of March, and who knows where the markets will be at that time. But we can be pretty sure that whether markets are still at all-time highs at the end of March, we will see all-time highs again. It's a recurring theme for investors to experience and see all-time highs in the stock market, to ask themselves, should I still be investing right now, even though things are at an all-time high? What goes up must come down, right? Peter and I dig into that. My monologue today is on that topic as well. But before we get to that, as always, we're going to do a quick listener review. This comes from Apple Podcasts. Please, guys, I really appreciate it. And I love reading your reviews. I love seeing the ratings. Usually they're 5-star ratings. So thank you so much on Apple Podcasts. So if you are so inclined, please go ahead and leave me a review. I'd love to read it on the podcast. I'd love to send you one of our super soft Best Interest t-shirts. And this review comes from Jeremy Schneider, very well known from Personal Finance Club on Instagram. And Jeremy, a former guest of the Best Interest podcast, Jeremy talked about the 7 sins of investing on the Best Interest podcast. And Jeremy wrote in and said, Jesse knows his stuff. His kind and thoughtful approach to personal finance and investing shines through in the Best Interest podcast. If you want a voice of reason to cut through all the nonsense you hear in the world, definitely check out the Best Interest podcast. So, Jeremy, thank you so much for the kind words. If you're listening to this, Jeremy, drop me a note, jesse@bestinterest.blog, and I will send you out a super soft t-shirt out to you in San Diego, California. You can rep the Best Interest on the beach volleyball courts there. I know Jeremy is a big beach volleyball player. All right, guys, let's get into the good stuff. Let's talk about the upcoming market crash. Yes, that's right. I'm going to read for you an article I wrote in 2020 that's called The Market Crash is Coming Eventually. Because here on The Best Interest, I provide a lot of advice that rhymes with you should be investing. You should put more money into your investments. Every week, every month, every paycheck, you should be investing. I even share my specific investment choices, how I have my money invested and why. But today is different because I'm going to talk about the upcoming market crash. Well, it's coming eventually. I mean, maybe you've come to believe that I'm an unwavering bull, pure optimist, that I think investments can do nothing but increase in value. But that is not true. I know the crash will come because it always does. And that might seem scary. If the crash is coming, then why not do something about it? And that's what today's post, today's rant, today's monologue is about. Even though we're aware that a market crash is coming eventually, we can take a step back and we can think about it rationally today. So first, I want to talk about being a bull before a market crash, because here's a prediction. I predict that I will eventually make a podcast episode or write a blog post where I say something like, I bought some shares of an index fund this month, just like every other month, and I think it's one of the smartest things you can do as an investor. And then after that future blog post, the market will proceed to fall by 30% over the next few months, right? We're talking here in March 2024. For all I know, a crash is coming in April. I don't know. I'm still going to be investing right now in March of 2024. I can tell you that in 2021, I was still investing, even though 2022 eventually came and the stock market dropped, whatever it was, 23%, 25%, something like that. I am going to make content, and in my own life, I am going to be investing right before the market crashes. And some people, when that occurs, will look at the best interest, will look at me and say, "Guy Jesse doesn't have a clue what he's talking about. He just invested $1,000 last month in the S&P 500, and then the market crashed. Well, what a dummy." So I'm calling it right now. That has happened before, right? I've been writing for 5.5 years. I've been podcasting for 4 years. And if you know what happened in the last 5.5 years or 4 years, you will have known that the market had a few corrections, a couple bear markets, COVID, 2020, 2022. That happened. I was investing the whole time. I was throwing money at the market right before it crashed. And I understand why it appears like I might be a dummy. So we should dig in. Am I a dummy? Okay. Let's first look at some historical data, because the market crash always comes. At least it always comes eventually, right? Bear markets, where the stock market has dropped by 20% or more from its previous times, there have been 13 of them since 1929. The craziest one, the Great Depression, the market dropped 86%. And it's such an outlier. And because the U.S. economy and the Federal Reserve and the gold standard, so many things have changed since then, that a lot of people, they really look from 1950 onward or from World War II onward, where we've had plenty of bear markets of 22 and 36 and 34. And in 73 through 78, there was a 48% bear market. The dot-com bubble, 49% bear market. The financial crisis, 56%. The ebbs and flows, the oscillating between unsustainable optimism and unjustified pessimism. If we believe the assumption that stock prices are currently unsustainably optimistic, then it's believable that a serious bear market could happen in the next few years. But lesser corrections, typically defined as at least a 10% drawdown, they occur even more frequently. Since 1950, there have been 40 of these corrections of 10% or more. That's more frequent than one every 2 years. It doesn't take Nostradamus or Madame Cleo or the great Carnac to predict that kind of future market downswing. It's not that we're calling some one in 1,000 event. Market corrections, 10%, something like that, they happen all the time. In fact, 2023, I'm reminding all my clients of this as I meet with them right now. Last year, 2023, in the March-April timeframe, we had an 8% correction. And then in the August-September-October timeframe, we had a 10% correction in the stock market. That's two small corrections in the same year. And when you combine them, that's an 18% drawdown. And you see that from the outside looking in, and you might think, boy, that's a rough year. And yet, what happened last year? The market finished up 25%. Those kind of drawdowns happened all the time. They always will. They always have. That is the nature of the stock market. It's a feature, not a bug. And our job as long-term investors is to hold through thick and thin. Now, this was very appropriate when I originally wrote this article in 2020. It's appropriate again here in 2024. What if he gets elected? Great question. You can find arguments from both sides of the political aisle that certain parties lead to better stock market performance. But we need to dive in and investigate the data itself. So we can look at the president alone and see what party he or she is in, and then see how the market has performed. But we need to realize this is a slightly dangerous game, because does the president alone have enough influence to affect the stock market? Will the answers we find here be conclusive of causation, or will they only present correlation? If we look at from 1926 to today, we have close to 100 years of S&P 500 data. We've had Democratic presidents, we've had Republican presidents, and there is a difference, actually. Republican years saw an average S&P 100 return in the 9 to 10% range, while Democratic years saw an average return in the 14% range. That's a pretty big difference. But is it causal, right? Does the party of the president cause the market to go up a certain amount? Can a system as complicated as the stock market, as the U.S. economy, be tied down to a single influencing variable like the president's political party? Probably not. And after all, that's only 24 presidential terms and 16 individual presidents, 8 Republicans, 8 Democrats. It's not exactly a huge sample set. So keep this in mind the next time you hear someone talking about President X leading to stock market success or failure. Now, if we combine the president and Congress, it presents another interesting working theory. The theory is that our government is more efficient when Congress, that's both houses, Senate and representatives, is controlled by the president's party. The idea being, if the president and Congress work together effectively, then we all benefit. Teamwork makes the dream work. In the 100 or so years, the same historical period that I mentioned before, we've had 48 years of presidential and congressional unification, and we've had 51 years of presidential and congressional division. The market performance during those periods is very interesting. What we see is that during the total unified years where teamwork was making the dream work, the S&P average annual return was about 14%. And during the divided years, it returned about 10%. Now, again, is this causal? Does a unified federal government ensure that the economy and stock market perform better? I have no idea. I doubt it's conclusive. Okay, it's interesting nonetheless. But the real important takeaway that I take from this, at least, is that the market trends up and to the right, no matter who is in office. It might appear that political cooperation is helping grease the wheels, but ultimately, the stock market is driven on business fundamentals, is driven on business earnings. There is probably some correlation, maybe even causation between, well, if certain laws can get passed that make it easier for American businesses to thrive, then the market will do better. I get it. But ultimately, this is more than macroeconomic. It's like macro socioeconomic. It's such a big factor in such a complicated system that I recommend ignoring it altogether. There is a silver lining of market crashes. Back when we consulted Mr. Market on the blog, one of the big takeaways of Benjamin Graham's Mr. Market parable is that the only two prices that ever matter are the price when you buy and the price when you sell. Nothing in between. So ask yourself, what are your investing plans for the next few years? Are you going to be a buyer, someone who is investing for the future? Or are you going to be a seller, someone who has invested for the past few decades and now wants to live off those investments? If you're a buyer, then the market crash has a pretty significant silver lining: cheaper prices. If the market declines, then you get to invest at lower prices. It's the easiest way to increase your long-term investing potential. Buy low, sell high. Dollar-cost averaging investors relish these chances to decrease their cost basis. Now, if you're a seller, let's look at how your past 30, 35 years have been. The S&P 500 value was around 350 in 1990, and it's at 5,000 today. What's that? About 15 times higher? If the market drops by 20% next week down to 4,000, now your returns are only 12x, right? Instead of 15x. But a 12x return is not bad. Now, I know one of the biggest questions on your minds today, it's definitely something Peter and I talk about, is if the market crash is coming, why not just sell now, wait to reinvest after the prices drop? Before I answer that question, let's consult Peter Lynch, who's considered one of the most successful investors of all time. Peter Lynch famously said, "More money has been lost by investors preparing for corrections than has been lost in the corrections themselves." Okay, what exactly is Lynch saying there? How do people lose money by preparing for corrections? Well, they lose money preparing for corrections because they sell too soon and then they don't know when to buy back in. It's that simple. Both of those actions, selling too soon and then not buying back in soon enough, can cause investors to miss out on years of growth and years of dividends. That's why Peter Lynch's quote rings so true. Timing the market is impossibly hard. So we don't sell in preparation for a crash. Now, the next logical question is, well, what about saving up cash right now and then waiting to buy? Why not hold cash, wait for the 10% drop in the market, which we know happens pretty often, and then buy in? Well, that's been looked into too. For example, I wrote an article back in March 2020. I called it Viral Stock Market Strategies because it's something a lot of people were talking about in COVID, where we looked at an assortment of supposed strategies that involve holding onto cash while waiting for the market to drop. And if you backtest those kind of strategies against the historical S&P 500 data, simple dollar cost averaging beats all of the buy the dip strategies. So I'll say that again. Simple dollar cost averaging over time beats any type of buy the dip strategy you want to propose. So if you think there's a market crash coming, I do too, eventually. I just don't know when. There's certainly a chance that holding onto cash and waiting for the crash is correct right now. There's a chance that's right. But if that's going to be your tactic all the time, if you're going to try that tactic for the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, it will be a losing strategy. Don't sell for fear of a market crash and don't wait to buy for that fear of a market crash. Carry on with your normal investing cadence. The last question, and it's a big question. What if this is the crash? What if it's the big one, the mother of all crashes? What if society falls apart? What if a meteor hits Earth and life changes as we know it? What if we all start scavenging for beans and scrap metal and fuel for our souped up dirt bikes, just like in Mad Max? Those are scary questions, but they actually have a pretty simple answer. If an existential threat ruins your investments, then the stock market will be the least of your worries. That's it. If the big one hits, then the stock market will be one of many societal structures that essentially no longer matter. If it's not the big one, though, then the market will recover. It always has and it always will. Now, why is that the case? Why does the market always bounce back? In part, it's because humans are resilient. We learn and grow. We work towards progress. We innovate. While the COVID market recovery, for example, could be attributed to many different factors like the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, it can also be attributed to human resilience. If the big one is coming, then maybe you should just YOLO and spend your money right now. But I suppose we all need to do some probability analysis in that case. What are the odds that the big one is about to come and that you're going to look stupid, that your investments become worthless? Versus what are the odds that the big one never comes and you wish you had invested in your younger years to enable a successful retirement? I'll take my chances and save for retirement. So going back to one of the initial questions, am I a dummy? I hope I've convinced you otherwise. Even though we know that the stock market crash, the stock market correction, the bear market will eventually come, we will eventually have 10 or 20% or even larger drawdowns, there's still no basis that you'll benefit by trying to wait for that or by trying to time that market crash. It might work, but it usually doesn't. That's what the historical data tells us. Waiting for the election doesn't really matter either. Democrats, Republicans, the market ends up doing its own thing. There might be some causality there, but it's very hard to tell. And there are silver linings in corrections and crashes. If you're investing for the long run, then corrections enable cheaper prices and greater returns. And if this market crash is the big one, well, then none of it really matters. It'll be hard to podcast, though, if the electrical grid fails.
Here's a quick ad, and then we'll get back to the show. Every week, I send a quick free email to thousands of readers that shares three simple things. One, my new articles and podcasts. Two, the best financial content of the week from all over the internet. And three, a financial chart that explains some important concept in the news that week. It's a great primer to boost your financial know-how.
But Jesse, I don't want another email.
Well, this might not be for you, but I do hear you, which is why I make it very short, sweet, and full of only the essentials. A whopping 66% of subscribers read my email at least once a month. They're enjoying it, and maybe you will too. You can subscribe for free on the homepage at bestinterest.blog. Again, that's a free, no-strings-attached subscription at bestinterest.blog.
So with that, I want to bring on Peter Lazaroff. As I mentioned before, Peter is the chief investment officer at PlanCorp in St. Louis, a multi-billion dollar wealth management firm serving clients across the country. Peter also hosts the Long-Term Investor podcast, terrific podcast. We'll mention a few different things, a few different episodes of Peter's that'll all be in the show notes. So without further ado, let's bring on Peter Lazaroff. Peter, here we find ourselves early March 2024. While stocks happen to be down today, it's about 1 p.m. Eastern. I'm sorry, 2 p.m. Eastern here as we're recording. The market, whether it's the S&P, the NASDAQ, the Dow, is nevertheless, we are at all-time highs right now. So let's talk a little bit about investing at all-time highs. What is the logical or rational way to approach this question, Peter? Should we be investing at all-time highs?
It's interesting. When you look at the data, we are actually at an all-time high more often than we're in a bear market. And when you think about the fact that on average in any given year, like 75% of years, the market is up. You know, if we were gambling people, and maybe we are making a bet on capitalism when we invest in stocks and such. But truly, if you had to guess, the probabilities would suggest the market's going to be higher. And if it's going to be higher, well, then that means that we're going to be hitting new all-time highs. But I do understand the feeling investors have when you're at an all-time high. Because on one hand, it means things are going well. It's a testament to growth and resilience of the market. But then they also have this little sense of, hey, does this mean we're on the brink of a downturn? Because whatever goes up must come down. It's sort of the narrative we tell ourselves in our head. But really, even as I look at some of the closing data, just looking at monthly data going back to 1926, following an all-time high, the average annual return on the S&P 500 is 13.7% 1 year later. And we average 10.6% per year over the subsequent 3 years and 10.2% over the 5 years following a new all-time high. And that really isn't that different from just any sort of historical annualized return. So on one hand, it's great. On the other hand, like many things in investing, the best action is often inaction.
Yeah, I like that. That's the John Bogle quote. Don't do something, just stand there.
Yeah.
Right? Just in action. Well, it sounds like part of that data series then is just the idea that all-time highs happen all the time. And that's part of your argument right there is that I think whether it's us as individuals or maybe we're kind of pushed by the financial media into thinking like, whoa, here's this crazy thing that's going on. We're at an all-time high. Well, it's not that crazy because it's happening all the time. You did hit on a couple things there, which is, you know, well what about what goes up must come down? That's a very human thought. Or what about this investing axiom we've all heard before, buy low, sell high? Well, if we're at an all-time high, shouldn't I be selling right now?
Yeah, it's a really good point. The first one, like what goes up must come down. Yes, that did come out of my mouth in part because it's what a lot of people think of. And just because the market making all-time high isn't necessarily a distinct risk worth making a change to your portfolio, I still acknowledge that markets are cyclical. Nothing goes up forever. And one of the things as an investor that you absolutely must do in order to earn a reasonable return is assume some degree of risk and uncertainty. I mean, if it's just the cost of higher expected returns in stocks than what you would earn in cash and bonds, yes, if the stock market goes straight up, it will pull back. It will go down at some point. On average, just using the S&P 500 because it's well known and people talk about it a lot, it's not necessarily the whole market, but great proxy. The S&P 500 averages a 10% loss about every 12 months. So any pullback should be expected. I mean, it's laughably normal. And then you see historically that 20% drops happen about every 3.5 years, and then 30% or greater drops happen about once a decade. So for me, seeing a great rally from October 2023 to the present, March 2024. If we just keep going up and up and up, then yeah, I think there is some sort of pullback. But Jesse, you and I, we are long-term investors. We are not concerned about missing the 10% pullback. Yes, it would be profitable if we could foresee it and time it and get out of stocks and somehow not pay taxes and then get back into stocks at the exact right time. That would all be wonderful. I'm not saying that would be a bad thing. That would be wonderful. I would love to do that. That would be buying high and selling low. But in reality, we can't really know when those downturns are going to occur. And if we have a financial plan that takes into account volatility like I discussed, downturns like I just discussed with a similar magnitude and frequency as we've experienced in the past, well, then we don't really have to worry about whether this all-time high is just the latest mile marker, like latest milestone on the continued trend up and to the right, or if we're at a peak and it doesn't get any better than this and we go into a bear market, which on average takes about 2 years to decline and then come back to the previous peak. We never really know. But I do think you try your best to remember why you're investing in stocks, which in my mind, you invest to grow your wealth at a rate greater than inflation without taking undue risk. Undue risk. Yes, sitting in the stock market at an all-time high is not an undue risk. Trying to avoid a downturn introduces a lot of unforced error, a lot of undue risk. And even as the market is going up, if you are a diversified investor across stocks and bonds, you can actually buy low and sell high via rebalancing. So look, it's a catchy headline. It's hopefully a headline that we see a lot. I love seeing that it's all-time highs. It means I, as an investor, have made money. It means that the economy is doing well and that companies are doing well and that chances are, because over the long term, stock prices tend to follow company earnings pretty closely, it means that earnings are looking pretty good.
I'm glad you touched on many of those topics there, Peter. I want to come back to rebalancing. I want to come back to earnings at some point because those are important topics that fit into this conversation of investing at all-time highs. But specifically, I want to respond to the idea of the frequency of different percentage drops that you have, right? So I'm talking to the 33-year-olds out there. I'm 33 right now. So talking to the 33-year-olds listening to the Best Interest Podcast, you might own a large percentage of stocks, stay till you're 53, and then you'll start to eventually start shifting maybe more into bonds by the time you're 63. But even as you retire and now you're 73 and 83, you still might have a portion of stocks in your portfolio. So you might have 50 years in the future of having stocks in your investment portfolio.
And based on some of the 20% and 30% decline data that you gave us, we're setting ourselves up for what? Sounds like 15 instances of 20% drops before we drop dead at 83 and 5 or 6 instances of a 30% drop. Like, this is expected. We know this stuff is going to happen. And something that I like to do with myself and with my clients and with my listeners and readers is prepare them for that fact. Get ready. Get your armor on right now because it's going to happen.
Well, and even NASA, who sends astronauts to space, does what they call exposure therapy. Mm-hmm. And they go over everything that could possibly go wrong so that in the moment, they can remain calm. Because once your brain, I mean, there's real strong science about this, that the moment that there is fear and anxiety inside the brain, then you don't make logical, rational choices. And so I love, there's some podcasts about NASA training. They go through some of the things that they talk about, and they can't predict every single thing that might go wrong, but it's all about the practice of slowing everything down. And I think that can be applied to markets where I kind of put out the same information that you just said, where if you're sitting down and we're talking to the 33-year-olds in the house that, hey, you're going to have like a dozen of these in your lifetime. Every single client I get in front of, I say, hey, in our lifetime working together, we're going to go through multiple 30%+ drops. And I can't tell you why they're going to happen, but they're going to be scary. And each one is going to feel different and feel like that history doesn't matter. And look, there are some things that are different, but that doesn't mean that what you're doing when you're investing, which is providing capital to companies who are trying to earn more profit, that will still be true. Now, if you as an investor for some reason are providing capital to companies who don't like profit, then that is different and concerning. That is where financial theory doesn't exist anymore. It all falls apart. It exists. It's just all wrong at that point.
Right. It's funny. It's almost similar to the idea of timing the market. It's, of course, none of us want to be investing in unprofitable companies that are just siphoning money into the nether void. But sometimes we own those, like index fund investors. It's something, it's so funny. I was just talking to someone the other day about how when they own a portfolio of, say, 50 individual names, 50 individual stocks, there's something in the human brain that looks at that and says, okay, well, these 30 are doing well, but why the hell do we own Disney? What's up with that? And I want to sell that. It's BS. Get it out of here. What's the point of owning it still? If you had owned S&P 500 index fund, you would still own Disney. Actually, I don't know for sure if Disney's in the S&P. I think it is.
But yeah.
Something about the wrapper of the index fund, you know, the index fund is up 14% year to date or whatever it is. And people just ignore the fact that 60% of those companies in the index fund might have lost money or might be down on the year. And it just kind of gets wiped away. But just an interesting little aside there. One thing that you did say that I thought was very, very interesting is this idea of you can never really time the market. Of course, we would love it if you could. We would love it if you knew exactly when to sell and exactly when to buy back in, and you could avoid any sort of tension and anxiety that comes with investing at all-time highs. You mentioned before, you brought up the market's performance since late October, early November of 2023. And I just think it's so interesting that you could have sat there, anyone listening could have sat here in mid-October 2023 and put together an extremely rational argument for why the market was going to continue into this uncomfortable slide downward, just as it did through August, September, and most of October last year. And I would have sat there and said, yeah, all those points totally make sense. And then Jay Powell comes out at the end of October, says a couple things about interest rates, and the market rips 8% in 1 week and 19% before the end of the year. So that rational argument that you would have made in the middle of October completely got imploded by what actually happened. And it just, it just proves that point of it's really hard to get the timing of this right. And it's probably not worth trying in the first place.
You know what I love about your Fed example is even the Fed doesn't know what they're going to do with interest rates. So if we go back to 2022, worst bond market on record, full stop. And at the beginning of the year, so the Federal Reserve, the Federal Open Market Committee, the group within the Federal Reserve that's setting interest rate policy, after each of their meetings, they publish what is called the dot plot. And it's they basically put dots where they think that they will be setting interest rates themselves 6 months from now, 12 months from now, 2 years from now, et cetera. And none of them at the beginning of 2022 thought that they'd be raising interest rates from 0 to 5%. None of them. None of them had really anything going on. And like you said, in October, Jerome Powell comes out and says, hey, actually, we may not be cutting interest rates, even though their dot plot said that they might. They're just humans, too. They don't know what's going to happen. What's really challenging for investors of all types, and even for financial advisors, I think advisors sometimes suffer from this more than end clients, is that you hear someone make this extraordinarily intelligent case, full of facts, objectively factual case for bad things to happen. And it sounds smart. And then you hear guys like us saying, well, you know, just stay the course. Everything's going to be fine. Staying the course doesn't mean putting your head in the sand and saying, I don't, you know, there's nothing bad going on. However, it is hard to digest, whether you're an investor professionally or you have an advisor or you're doing it yourself, to see these really intelligent cases and be like, no, that just doesn't make sense. Yes, everything they're saying is true. But you know what? Millions of market participants are out there, have that information also, and they are pricing in the probability that that person's thesis will lead to impending doom. The other thing is, like, people predict doom because they know it's what gets them airtime. And I think knowing what people's motivations are really important. I feel like if you put up a bearish bet, like on CNBC, you should also be required to disclose what is in your portfolio. Like, you ask those guys, well, what's in your 401k? Well, it's a bunch of index funds. I would never change those. Yeah. Like, maybe in their taxable account, they have some trades on. But for the most part, I think that you know, the Fed themselves, the people setting interest rates, in hindsight, we could call the perfect catalyst for this run-up. They didn't know they were going to do it. And anyone who, to your point, was making the perfect bear case, you know, they were wrong. And even if they were right and there was a decline, who's to say that the reason that the decline, you know, the theoretical decline happened even aligned with what they were saying in the first place? It's just such a tough thing to do. And I think sometimes it's easy for advisors like us to be on a bit of a soapbox and say, like, it's so silly to listen to this. But everybody involved is humans, and humans love stories. And look, a doom story is just more interesting. It's why the media sells it. So here's what you know when you're listening to the two of us, is that we're not concerned about what's happening next week, next month, even next year. We're in it for the long game. And when you catch a soundbite of somebody, it is extraordinarily rare, unless their name's Warren Buffett, that they're in it for the long game. And they have an agenda, and it's different than yours. You have multiple decades to ride out what these downturns that we've talked about a few times that we know are going to occur. Just tune it all out. Now, if you want to do it like a hobby, like I do fantasy baseball, or, you know, like I watch professional sports, that's totally different. And I actually don't mind it when people carve out a small portion of their portfolio and they time the market and they buy individual stocks and they make all sorts of bets. And, like, that's great. That's fine. But 90 to 95% of your wealth should just be staying the course in a long-term strategic asset allocation. It has been shown time and time again, financial theory and long-term investing are effectively undefeated. And it's just hard to recognize, because the long-term is an eternity to live through in the moment.
And it's so human to think, so wait a second, like, Peter was just telling me, and Jesse apparently supports Peter, in that the boring thing is the right thing. You're saying it's not the flashy thing. You're saying it's not the Wall Street secrets. You're saying, I mean, Robert Kiyosaki, he wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad. It's like the best-selling book in the personal finance space ever. And he's got a headline every single day calling for doom and gloom in some way. You're telling me he's wrong? But to me, like, Robert Kiyosaki is the poster child of what you were saying, Peter, of what are the incentives? And Robert Kiyosaki, it stinks, because I've actually had readers and listeners, they've heard me rail against Kiyosaki before. And a few have reached out to me and been like, Jesse, I don't get it. Like, I just read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and I kind of liked it. Like, it clicked with me and I understood it. And now here you are saying these bad things about him. A quick detail about that is, I think the book actually espouses some reasonable thoughts about owning income producing assets. And then he leveraged his fame into being a snake oil salesman for the past 25 years. I mean, both of those things.
That's right. I agree with that take, by the way, for whatever it's worth.
Thank you. Yeah. And like, it's okay to say that both are true. It's a reasonable book. And he's now shilling. I don't even know if he believes his own statements. I think he doesn't. That's my take. I don't think he believes what he says, but he knows that it attracts eyeballs. What's the one thing? Basically, if you can instill fear in someone, you can probably then sell to them. And that's what he does. So no respect there from me. But when
I'm with you, we're on the same team there.
And he's probably the worst of them, or at least the worst of them that get a lot of airtime. But there's
Ramsey isn't necessarily harmful, but he's stubborn to the point. He actually reminds me of Eugene Fama, who's unwilling to acknowledge behavioral finance. I once asked Eugene Fama, Nobel laureate, efficient market hypothesis guy for all those listening. I once asked him, hey, is there anything that you know to be true without data? And I was hoping he'd say, yeah, like humans are fearful and greedy, or like say, he's like, there's nothing you can know without data. I was like, okay, well, thanks, buddy. Just sticking to his guns, talking his book. But Dave Ramsey, Dave Ramsey has a brand and it's anti-debt. Even if that is not the optimal choice financially, which by the way, the optimal financial choice is not always the right choice for every human, but he's willing to do it. He's willing to steer people that direction, even when it's not the right choice for them, the human. And Dave Ramsey does so many good things. Again, like you said, both can be true. We don't live in a black and white world, just like in the market. We're at an all-time high and a lot of things can be bad. Both can be true. So many shades of gray. And I think they're incentives are just so important when you think about who is giving financial advice. Now, Jesse, you and I would bet that our biggest incentive is that we would love listeners to become clients of our firms. Okay. Yeah. That's an incentive. That doesn't seem as harmful as I want you to follow me. I want you to buy my stuff. Like, a lot of what we do, if someone has all the time in the world and can be completely objective all the time, maybe they don't need an advisor. I mean, I have a personal trainer. I have someone who cleans my house. I have someone who cuts my lawn. I have an executive coach. You know, the coach, the trainer, that probably falls more into the bucket of what we do, where you get regular feedback, it's better. But look, when I have a health issue, I still go to a doctor. I do WebMD the heck out of it, and that's not good. It's not healthy. I shouldn't do that. Every time I get sick, my wife's like, don't Google anything. Do not open Google. I think that people can fall into the same trap with investing where there's so much information out there, but unlike medical information that is, I'm going to say pure science, at least it should be pure science. There's so much bad stuff in the finance world that is not science. And what's really confusing about the science of investing is that the evidence typically cuts both ways. And so the example I'll give to a lot of people is, like, if you're trying to choose whether to include or exclude something from your portfolio or make some sort of change to your investments, if you take an approach like the FDA does, where they're seeking to approve a drug and they want to approve something that's net beneficial to society, but minimizes like bad side effects, you're going to fail to approve some drugs if you're worried about the side effects. Now, we could have the FDA that just approves everything that has a slightly good test, even if they're bad side effects. And that'd be a problem too. What I'm talking about is actually, I mean, you're an engineer, Jesse. You like type 1 and type 2 air. We could talk statistics, but I don't know if the listeners will revolt. But I'm talking about type 1 and type 2 air. And in general, my feeling is that I am more concerned about implementing a bad idea than missing out on a good one. And I think when you look at the investment world, the evidence-based, peer-reviewed investment world, like a doctor, like you're practicing medicine, with that lens of recognizing that the vast majority of success comes from a couple really big decisions and then just minimizing mistakes after that, I think it does start to simplify stuff. Now, here we've been talking for, I don't know, I haven't been keeping track, let's say 20, 30 minutes. We don't always get that long to get people's attention. That's why the soundbite people win, because they have soundbites that are catchy and actionable. And like you said, steer some fear. A little bit of a tangent, but interesting nonetheless.
I liked it. I really liked it. You reminded me of one of my favorite Buffett quotes. He tells us this little story. It's not very quotable because it's almost a little too long, but essentially that investing is a no called strike game.
Yes.
Right? Baseball is a called strike game where you can have the bat on your shoulder in baseball. If the pitcher throws three strikes, well, then you're out. So you're incentivized to swing in baseball. Well, there's no called strikes in investing. And you can sit there with your bat on your shoulder. And if you don't like the opportunities that are presented to you, you don't have to swing at them. And you can wait for the perfect pitches. You can take your swings at those. Hopefully, most of them are successful. And all the ones that you didn't swing at, you're not any worse off for having not swung. But I think a lot of people don't realize that fact and feel some sort of obligation to swing, some obligation to act. on whatever news or opportunity they're presented with, and you simply don't have to.
Well, if we transport ourselves 100,000 years back into the jungle, and Jesse, you and me are standing there, and we hear a rustling in the bushes, and you take off running because, you know, you assume it's a lion, and then I sit there calculating the probability of it being a lion versus the wind, I get eaten. So, you know, like you survived because of that instinct to act when there's a little bit of a threat. It happens with our money. It happens with every sort of decision we make. Well, since I've already mentioned our primary bias as advisors is that that's one of the things advisors do for you. They just take the emotion out of it. Even me, I sort of treat my money. I have it all invested in a single globally diversified mutual fund, in part so that I don't ever have to think about trading or rebalancing or asset allocation, because I'm overseeing a lot of assets and I can approach those with a robotic discipline. You know, from my first, let's call it decade of being a professional, I don't know that I was robotic and systematic. In fact, I know I made mistakes. And so it's sort of finding a way to take it out of your hands and getting those a couple really good decisions in place and then just staying out of the way, making sure you don't make mistakes. The only mistake I can make with money that's designed for 30 or 40 years from now, even 20 years from now, but probably more likely 30 or 40, just don't touch it. Like I did all the research. I did all the homework. I got it what it needs to be in. It might do poorly for the next 10 years, but it's very rare over 20 or 30 years that if I go back to that very simple first principle level investing purpose is to grow my wealth at a rate greater than inflation. That's all I got to do. And historically, stocks have delivered a rate of 7% above inflation over the long term. Does that mean, even though like a headline you might read today, actually there are lots of them, is that valuations are really high and so expected returns are lower over the next 10 years? Fine. I mean, they were negative in the noughts. So, you know, I'd say part of the reason we're having such a good run right now is that we had such a hideous run through the noughts. And part of the reason we had such a hideous run through the noughts is because we had such a killer run from like 1982 to 1999. And, you know, before that, we had another terrible run. So, hey, talk about full circling something. What comes up must go down. And I said, yeah, things are cyclical. The thing, again, is that if you're investing in the market, you're making a bet on human ingenuity. Oh my gosh, can I even say that word? You don't have to cut that out. You don't even need to cut that out because I don't think I've ever successfully said that word. I can type it and spell it though. You're betting on that. And you're betting on the fact that like companies like making money. As long as they like making money, I don't care what the rules are. The rules are always going to be changing with governments, with people, but there are some things that just never change.
Here's a quick ad, and then we'll get back to the show. One of the more common questions I hear is, Jesse, what do you like and use? Books, blogs, podcasts, even banks and brokerage firms. What are your recommendations? So to answer that question, I put together a webpage. You can check it out at bestinterest.blog/recommendations. Again, that's bestinterest.blog/recommendations to check out how I'm improving my financial life. I just put a chart together the other day and published it in my most recent blog post. So I suppose we'll link to it in the show notes so that listeners can see the chart. But I had this hypothetical investor. I took Robert Shiller's data back to 1871 before the S&P even existed. It's just U.S. stock market data. Threw $1,000 back in 1871 and then just let it ride. And I didn't want to inflation adjust it only because I kind of wanted to view it through the lens of an actual investor who, they know inflation might be there, but really they're just looking at the dollars in their account. I didn't want to have to deal with taxes, so we didn't look at taxes. But I did assume that all dividends were reinvested. And the question I wanted to ask myself is, what was the longest period of time in between all-time highs, if you will? Or what kind of crash and what was the duration of a bear market or a crash where someone's account value was below a previous all-time high? And one of the most significant ones actually was the noughts with the dot-com bubble, where there was this tiny little gap in between technically, but it was such, I think it was like 1 or 2 months in length between where the dot-com bubble technically recovered and really where the great financial crisis would have started to impact you. It was 140 months in total though. So if I take away that tiny gap in between those two periods and just think of it as one long period, 140 months, which is what, 13 years and change.
That's wild.
No, 11 years and change. I'm sorry, but still 11 years and change. Where technically speaking, not even accounting for the fact that inflation was eating away at your dollars for those 11 years, But 11 years where someone's account value ostensibly was lower than a previous all-time high. And again, that's the kind of information that stock investors need to steel themselves with, is this idea that you're signing up for the potential where you will go 5 or 7 or even up to 10 years with your account technically being lower, or the value of your stocks technically being lower than a previous high. It's not a great feeling, but it's important to know.
Well, and if you're a diversified investor, you own global stocks, which you've probably hated for the past decade.
Right.
But a great stat that I'll butcher, and so I'll say about and approximately so that nobody's compliance gets upset. But basically, in years in which U.S. stock returns are less than 6%, international stocks beat U.S. stocks something like 94% of the time. I know the number's over 90%, but I think it's 94. And then periods in which U.S. stock returns are below 4%, international stocks have won every single time. And so you think of, and we're kind of down a rabbit hole of some sort, but like one of the mistakes I see people making these days is only thinking about the S&P 500 and not wanting international stocks. And when they're adding new money, they're just plowing it into an S&P 500 index fund, which, believe me, there's a lot worse things you can do, but they forget that there was a 12-year period that you're outlining where the S&P 500 lost to cash. And that period I was talking about before 82 to 99, there was a 17-year period where the S&P 500 lost to cash. And, you know, Japan, it took them 3-4 decades to recover from their bear market. So it's not uncommon. And you know what? And when we talk about these kind of historical downturn numbers, I don't even feel like I'm making a market call, Jesse, when I say that in our lifetime, you said you're 33, I'm 39. It's going to happen again. We're going to have a 10 plus year period where U.S. stocks underperform cash, and it's not going to be fun. And people will say, is it the death of equities? Is it the death of the 60-40? Is it the death of long-term investing? All those headlines are going to be there. Will we still be doing podcasts, or will there be some new medium? I don't know, but we'll be talking about it, and we'll be here to tell you all, stay the course. We have seen this before, and things are cyclical. We'll have a day in the sun again.
I don't know if podcasts will exist, Peter, but I will say about 18 months ago, I got an email from a business development person at OnlyFans. Not even kidding. OnlyFans was trying to branch into personal finance and investing. They reached out and said, hey, do you want to start an OnlyFans channel? I said, no, thanks. I'm good. I'm more of a voice only, leave the cameras off, leave the clothes on. And that doesn't do well on OnlyFans, I think.
Yeah.
So I've been told. I haven't explored the business model myself, but you had mentioned this idea that businesses, publicly traded corporations, I mean, they are in the business of earning profits, and somehow that ties back to the stock market. But I think a lot of typical investors might not be aware of that fact, that the stock market isn't a casino. It might be random in the way that Burton Malkiel talks about a random walk, but it's not random in the way that it's completely untethered from reality. So what is that connection between the businesses like Apple or Coca-Cola and the actual stock prices that I see?
So there is a book that someone named Brian Feraldi put out a year or two ago, I think it was in 2022, that is called Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? And I feel like it is one of the best books on this topic. I feel like it should have gotten more attention than it got. There's a lot of really good data kind of jumbled up from, this isn't a comment about the book, but like you can find what I think is the key point of that book jumbled up in a lot more complicated formats across a lot of different platforms, which is basically that over the long term, stock prices follow their earnings very closely. Very, very, very closely. In the short term, there can be some deviations that are driven largely by investor psychology. Because when you think like large established businesses don't really change that much on a day-to-day basis, but the value that the investors will assign to those businesses, they can change rapidly just based on the broad psychology of all market participants. But what I think that Brian does really well in this book is walk through some hypotheticals that causes light bulbs to go off for both novice investors and extremely experienced investors. I think he does a wonderful job of like walking you step by step. It's a short read. So in the show notes, I would link to it. Why do stocks go up? And ultimately, you know, when you ask that question, his book is what comes to mind, because I think in many ways, to me, even though we had a bear market in 2022 and a bear market at the beginning of the pandemic, there's this part of me that feels like we've just been on a run since the financial crisis, since 2009. And I often find myself looking back there and people are like, oh, the Fed's no interest rates juiced return. Oh, like fiscal stimulus juiced return. Oh, it's all like this, that, or the other. So three things that are going to drive returns regardless of the period that you're looking at. The first is change in earnings. The second is cash return to shareholders, whether that is dividends or buybacks. And the third is valuations. And so while people are saying, oh, Fed, you know, the Fed is driving returns, fiscal stimulus is driving returns, changes in valuation, like investor behavior, all these things, you look at the data and it's change in earnings. The rally that we have had from 2009 to present. And yes, again, two bear markets occurred in that. But to me, we're like, I'm looking at it as almost like a secular bull market. They've just tracked earnings. And today, with all the things going on around us in the world, in the country, in your local communities, with specific companies, with specific asset classes, at the end of the day, earnings are pretty good. I think a theme that seems to be coming up routinely in this conversation is like, both can be true, shades of gray. Bad things can be happening and companies can be growing earnings. I think when there are headlines like this company or that company laid off 15,000 people, relative to the size of the economy, that's not that much.
Right.
The
right.
jobs data is still really good. I don't know when the next bad thing is going to happen, but Carl Richards has a saying that risk is what's left after you've thought of everything else. And I love that. It is so right that we could bring in every brilliant mind in the world right now to this podcast and list off all the risks. And then the thing that ends up making everything topple will be something that wasn't mentioned. That's just how it works. So it's a brilliant quote. And I think I'm saying it correctly, that yeah. risk is what's left after you've thought of everything else.
That is a great quote. And it's very true. It's this idea that it's almost like it's parallel to black swans, isn't it? Like a black swan event, by its very definition, is something that you cannot plan for, could not have foreseen. And there are all these things that we're talking about today that are foreseeable in some ways. I guess I should take that back a little bit and just say that from the long-term investor's point of view, we say, well, you're not going to foresee some things and you should just stay the course. But yeah, you know, you and I, Peter, we're going to have conversations with clients in the future where we just have to say, yeah, didn't see that one coming. It's not fun. We knew something was coming eventually, though. And I think that's the important point, that we know that things will happen that will affect our portfolios and affect the market, and it won't be fun to deal with. And I think that's just an important takeaway to have. It's always
Jesse,
good.
Since we're deep yeah. into the conversation and probably yeah. people have dropped off, so I'll give them something fun to listen to. Billionaires, or I always picture like Mike Tyson owned a tiger, or like billionaires own exotic animals. Yeah. I would love to own a black swan because one, I've never seen one. And two, I would like that when people ask about it, that I could talk about black swan events and talk about why they're called that. So I think if I win the lottery, you can count that I will own a couple black swans.
You know that a swan is a real like son of a bitch of an animal. You know
yeah,
that, right,
well,
Peter?
Yeah, well, I'm a billionaire. So I'll have, in this scenario, I'm going to have a really big yard and I'll build yeah. it a lake. And when there's a bear market, maybe I'll slaughter one every time there's a bear market. Now I've really upset some of the listeners. It'll be like a ritual to the bull and bear gods to make it right.
Some listeners know that I'm on the board of the local SPCA here in Rochester, Lollipop Farm. But it's okay. Peter was joking, guys.
Was joking because one, I'm not going to slaughter a swan. And two, I don't think I'm going to win the lottery because I don't play it.
Smart. Very smart. And Peter, coincidentally, Brian Feraldi was nice enough. He stopped by a couple episodes ago on episode 74.
Holy
of
cow.
The Best Interest Podcast. Why Does the Stock Market Go Up? We talked about that book, a fantastic book. If you've spoken with, I don't know if you've spoken with Brian on your podcast, Peter, but he is a magnetic podcast guest. He just loves talking about stocks. I don't blame him, but we had a terrific conversation.
Yeah, he's great. So I don't know how many people we've lost in all of our rabbit holes during this conversation. Having a podcast myself, I know the longer we go, the more of you that have to like get out of the car and go to work or get on with your life. But yeah, Brian was on my show, The Long-Term Investor. He was episode 55.
Awesome.
But people should definitely go back. I'm going to go back and listen to yours. Knowing that I came after him, it just means your guests are getting worse. You're running out of good guests, Jesse.
Stop that. But no, you're right, Peter. I mean, this was an awesome, awesome conversation. How do people find you, Peter, whether it's the long-term investor, maybe they're in Greater St. Louis and they want to check out PlanCorp. How can people get in touch with you?
So I think going to the longterminvestor.com is probably the easiest, but you can go to peterlazaroff.com if you can figure out how to spell my last name or remember it. But the longterminvestor.com ends up redirecting to that anyways. And I'm at Peter Lazaroff on every platform. But Jesse, you were on my podcast. We had a great conversation. You were one of the most popular episodes I had ever recorded at the time. And so much that I believe resurfaced, and you and I have a new clip on YouTube from that conversation. So if you go to Peter Lazaroff on YouTube, you'll see Jesse Kramer laying down the facts. So, you know, it's fun. This is a fun format for meeting people, for talking to people. And if listeners are interested in learning more, once you go to the longterminvestor.com, you'll have everything you need.
That is awesome. Well, not only am I going to go check that out now because I'm excited to see myself on YouTube. Listeners, you know where to find Peter. And Peter, thank you so much for stopping by the Best Interest Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jesse.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Best Interest Podcast. If you have a question for Jesse to answer on a future episode, send him an email at jesse@bestinterest.blog. Again, that's jesse@bestinterest.blog. Did you enjoy the show? Subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever you listen. This helps others find the show and invest in knowledge themselves, and we really appreciate it. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Best Interest Podcast. The Best Interest Podcast is a personal podcast meant for education and entertainment. It should not be taken as financial advice and is not prescriptive of your financial situation.